Support for State Week comes from the following sponsors: PI.org, the Illinois Education Association, and Visit Springfield.
From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, as the state gets ready for the start of mail-in voting, there is growing concern that the federal government is trying to make it harder for some to cast a ballot. Illinois is among the states going to court over that issue. We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest this week, good to have back on the show, Peter Hancock. He covers state governments for Capital News Illinois. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's talk about what's going on. A lot of this at the federal level, but the state is watching this closely. President Trump issued an executive order back in the spring, and basically it's trying to prohibit anyone who's not listed on a federally approved database of U.S. citizens that are listed there from casting a mail-in ballot. And it instructs the Postal Service not to transmit those ballots from those individuals. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in on this just recently, I guess last week, reversing a lower court decision, allowing the process to continue playing out while these legal challenges go on. There's a lawsuit filed by several attorneys general, including Illinois' Kwame Raoul, to block Trump's plan from being implemented. So, Peter, we should mention the court did not sign off on Trump's plan completely, but where do things stand right now, again, as we get really close to the election season?
Right. It was a short-term temporary win, a procedural win for the Trump administration, but it's clearly not over yet. This could be one of those sleeper issues that a lot of voters don't realize is out there until it hits them when they go to cast a vote, if they're trying to vote by mail. Essentially, President Trump, like you just said, wants to have these state citizen lists. For each state, it will identify the residents there who are confirmed U.S. citizens over the age of 18 at the time of the election. And it authorizes the Postal Service to develop all kinds of regulations to control who can and cannot cast mail-in ballots, basically saying if you're not on that list, then the Postal Service will not pick up or deliver a mail ballot for you. As you said, Illinois, with Attorney General Kwame Raoul, was part of a coalition of states along with Washington, D.C., that challenged this in court. At the lower court, it was in Massachusetts, a judge enjoined the executive order. You can't go forward. The Supreme Court just this week lifted that injunction for the time being. And so it is moving forward. And the Postal Service has since finalized its regulations regarding the pickup and delivery of mail ballots and what the envelopes have to look like and all of that stuff. And so with that, the state of Illinois, along with, you know, mostly those same states in Washington, D.C., have filed another suit against the Postal Service, challenging those rules and trying to block those rules from going into effect. Now, all of this is happening it's now less than a month before mail-in voting begins here in Illinois. At this point, we don't know about the status of these citizenship lists. I asked the State Board of Elections spokesperson about it. They said, we have not seen a list. We haven't been told whether such a list exists. So we don't know to what extent this is going to be implemented, how it will be implemented. We're all just, you know, sitting back waiting to see how this is going to play out.
Yeah, and I think that's important because I have had people that I've talked to, and I'm sure people that are listening who may say, well, if somebody's a non-citizen, they shouldn't be voting. Okay, fair enough. But the problem with this, and you touched on it there, is the fact that we don't know who's on this list. Now, I'm a citizen of the U.S., but I don't know that my name suddenly wouldn't appear on this list. And I could go to cast a ballot or think I can do a mail-in ballot, and it wouldn't be counted or wouldn't be accepted. And I might not have time before the election to even appeal that decision. So that's really where this gets to be sort of a real problem here, because we're not sure who put this list together or even what these lists look like, right?
Well, yeah, and another problem is that according to the executive order, one of the sources that the Department of Homeland Security is supposed to use in putting together this list is what's called the SAVE database, and I forget exactly what that. It's an acronym, but it's essentially the database that many states use to determine whether somebody is eligible for federal benefits. It is notoriously full of holes. The accuracy rate is not anywhere near what you would want when you're dealing with people's right to vote. So there is a lot of concern about that people are going to be improperly scrubbed off the voter rolls, or they will not appear on the citizenship list and therefore will be denied access to a mail ballot. Many people will have other options. You can show up on election day. You'll have the option of appealing it if necessary. But then, if you're talking about people in nursing homes or people who are overseas, including soldiers overseas, other kinds of workers, expatriates who still vote in the United States but may not be residing here for the time, this could be a real problem for them.
Charlie, what's your thoughts?
How do you mean alternative? It strikes me that this is a, for want of a better term, this is a solution really looking hard to find a problem. President Trump is trying to make it look like there's all this chicanery going on with mail-in ballots. Yet, ironically, he himself votes by mail. He did it earlier this month in Florida's primary elections, and he's done it in the past. And it's extremely rare that non-citizens are voting. The Illinois State Board of Elections told a reporter that 10 non-citizens have been confirmed to have voted in an Illinois election since 1982. So that gives you an idea. Cook County Clerk's Office said it has no records of that happening. So it's extremely rare. And I was telling you guys before we started taping the show, it's more likely that you're going to get struck by lightning walking to the polling place than it is you're going to go in and find a non-citizen voting. But I'm looking at it that I see another motive here for the president's fixation on all this corruption in non-citizens voting. All the polls suggest that the Republicans are going to get clobbered in the midterms, and this will give the losing Republicans an opportunity to come in and say, well, the election was stolen from us. Trump has insisted that Biden won because of cheating. That's been totally disproved. That's a flat out lie, but he keeps repeating it. And I think you could look at it, maybe this is me being cynical, they're kind of setting the stage to explain away why they get creamed in November.
Well, another issue with this that I see, Peter, is the fact that you're putting a lot of emphasis on the postal system and also people who work for the postal service. And they're not election officials. In fact, most of them I've talked to have talked about how understaffed they are. So I'm not sure exactly how this exactly would work. But you have election officials. They're local. Many of them are elected. And it seems to me like you should leave it in the hands of those people.
Well, and that's one of the legal theories behind the challenge that the states are filing. Their claim is that the U.S. Constitution gives states the authority to set the rules for federal election about who can register and when the polling places are open. But it is subject to certain federal laws. The Department of Justice, and I think the Supreme Court noted this in their opinion, is that that's not entirely true, that Congress does, in fact, Has enacted many federal laws that impose requirements on states when it comes to federal elections. Some of the most significant of those would be, you know, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of the 1960s, which Martin Luther King Jr. worked so hard to pass. There was also the National Voter Registration Act, also known as the Motor Voter Law, I think from the 1990s, that required voter registration to be available when you conduct other kinds of government transactions, like getting your driver's license. And then in the early 2000s, following the Bush versus Gore debacle of the 2000 election, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, which did a number of things to modernize election systems, but also imposed requirements on states about maintaining voter registration rolls. So Congress has actually gotten involved. The Postal Service, on the other hand, as you point out, has not. Regulating elections is not their job, and they haven't. Congress has never authorized the Postal Service to serve that kind of a role in elections. And so that is one of the arguments being put forward in the challenge against the Postal Service regulations.
We'll be back with more on State Week in just a moment.
Support for State Week comes from PIORG, a nonprofit consulting firm providing resources for strategic planning, best practice implementation, and outcomes-focused program evaluation across the country, helping organizations make data understandable and actionable, enabling change makers to strengthen critical skills and serve others more effectively. PI, Plan, Implement, Evaluate. Services and information at PIORG.org.
We're back on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, along with Charlie Wheeler and Capital News Illinois reporter Peter Hancock. And Charlie, before we leave, I did want to point something out. There were some reports that, including from NPR, that in a call with Nevada election officials, the Department of Homeland Security acknowledged that the number that Trump had touted earlier, about 250,000 people, was a ceiling and that each voter still had to be manually reviewed. DHS then provided Nevada officials with a list of 185 names. That's a much different number from 250,000 pertaining to voters that they say they are confident are non-citizens. Nevada asked for more information about that smaller group and the data points to match them, and DHS declined to provide that. So at this point, like I said, as an election official, yeah, I think most of them are going to just try to move forward as they are. But boy, this leaves a lot of speculation about what's going to happen.
As I said before, I think it's trying to lay groundwork to explain why, if Republicans lose big time, well, they didn't really lose, but it was the Democrats cheating. And like in my case, I've been voting by mail, so to speak, since the pandemic. And I registered with our local county clerk, and he mails me a ballot. And it's interesting because he'll send me an email saying, we're going to send you a ballot. And he sends me an email, we sent you a ballot. And if you didn't get it, get back to us real quick. And then I fill it out. I don't mail it back because I'm too cheap to spend the stamp. I take it and put it at the drop box downtown, and it gets picked up. And then I'll get an email back from the county clerk. We picked up a ballot from you, and if you didn't vote, let us know. So here in Sangamon County, it's very, very efficient. And I found it very helpful, very useful. And I'm thinking, like you were talking before about the people who would be disadvantaged, people who live in rural areas, people who are elderly and maybe don't have transportation. And if I'm not mistaken, there's one Western state where they do all mail-in ballots. I think it may be Washington State.
I think, is it Oregon? I think it may be Oregon.
Or Oregon, yeah. What happens in an area like that where you disenfranchise, you know, literally thousands and thousands of people who have no idea that this is coming? By mail is becoming more popular in Illinois. According to the State Board of Elections, nearly 1 million of the 5.7 million votes cast in 2024 were cast by mail. But in some of those states, it's going to be a really an issue, and people are going to lose big time.
Peter, before we leave this topic, too, what's the likelihood that we get more clarification from the courts before this all gets underway with the election cycle here?
Well, that is kind of an open question. I think your guess is as good as anybody else's. There is that case, as I originally explained, from the federal court in Massachusetts, is now on appeal at the First Circuit Court of Appeals. We don't know when the First Circuit could rule, and whatever comes out of the First Circuit could be further appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. So final resolution of this particular case could be, you know, several weeks or months down the line, or the courts could decide to put it on the fast track. And now we have this new challenge, which has just been filed in that same federal court in Massachusetts, challenging the Postal Service regulations. And, you know, no matter what happens, of course, you know, the president's team, the Department of Justice, are masters at filing massive appeals and dragging the process out. So there are election experts throughout the country who are very concerned that this election, the rules have just kind of been thrown into chaos. I've seen that phrase a number of times. But at the same time, they're also saying, like you said, that elections are run by local officials. They tend to be people you and I know, that, you know, they're people's neighbors who live in our communities, and they do an incredibly efficient and honest job of running the elections. So the advice to the general public is do what you would normally do anyway and hope that it goes okay. In all likelihood, it will go okay. And if you run into problems, just, you know, go through the process of appealing and trying to clear up any misinformation that might be out there.
Back with more. We'll talk about education in a moment on State Week.
Support for State Week comes from Visit Springfield, featuring dozens of attractions and overnights on Route 66 in the capital city. Springfield is home to numerous Lincoln sites, Frank Lloyd Wright's Dana Thomas House, the Illinois State Capitol, and more. The Visit Springfield team can help organizers plan their event in the capital city. Attractions and tourism information at visitspringfieldillinois.com.
And we're back on State Week. I mentioned education. Peter, I'll go back to you. You had a chance to talk to both the Republican and Democratic nominees for governor, Darren Bailey, J.B. Pritzker, just recently, the state fair, of course, they were in town for, and talked about their visions for education. What should voters know about where the two stand?
Well, this is an important issue. It represents about 20% of the state's general revenue fund budget. It's close to $11 billion a year in state spending on K-12 education. And there are some significant issues, as we've been reporting throughout this year. We're now in the 10th year of what was called evidence-based funding. This was the formula that they adopted in 2017 that was supposed to send more monies to schools and with the focus on schools that were the most underfunded. And that's where the evidence-based portion comes in. They're using scientific research to determine how much it costs to educate students from different demographic groups. And so this was the year when we were supposed to have all of the districts up to the adequacy level. They would be at or above their adequacy target. And what we've reported is they're not there yet. The latest numbers on the distribution of EBF funds for this year shows that still about 70% of the districts are below their adequacy target. And we've also done reporting, you know, looking at the wealth-based inequities that existed at the time that the EBF formula was adopted. Over the last 10 years, Illinois has made significant progress achieving equity in the way money is spent. They have increased per pupil spending on instruction in the lowest wealth districts, but the property taxes are still incredibly inequitable. There are great disparities with people in the poorest districts paying property tax rates that are maybe twice as high as people in the wealthiest districts. And so I got a chance to, during press gaggles, got a chance to ask each of the candidates, what do you say about that? And what's your plan for education? Governor Pritzker acknowledges that we do need additional funding in education. The number of schools that are at or above adequacy has actually been dropping the last few years. And the overall adequacy gap, the difference between what districts are getting and what their adequacy target is, aggregated for the whole state, that gap is actually growing. Governor Pritzker acknowledges there needs to be more money, but then he just quickly pivots and says, despite that, look at how great we're doing. And he points to a number of metrics like the graduation rates, especially for minority groups. Points to eighth grade reading and math skills and the state's national rankings and says, overall, the state is doing better than it's improving and it's doing very well on certain metrics. The opposite message comes out of Republican Darren Bailey. When I ask him, how do you plan to improve education? His response is, look at how badly we're doing. And he points to the state report cards, the assessment scores on the statewide standardized tests for reading and math that show one half or more of students in Illinois are scoring below proficiency or below grade level in reading and math. And, when you point out, a large number of kids are going to schools that are underfunded, he says, that's not the problem. It's not about money. Everybody always wants to jump to money, but he says the problem is to get government out of the business and let local communities decide how to teach and what should be taught. I'm not entirely sure what that means or how that translates into greater performance, but that's his thing. On the one hand, Governor Pritzker is saying we're doing very, very well. And on the other hand, you have Darren Bailey saying we're doing very, very poorly. That's what I was able to get out of the candidates at the state fair.
And Charlie, maybe the truth is somewhere in the middle. There are some areas that have seen improvement, but there's certainly areas where a lot of improvement is needed.
Yeah, and I think part of it does boil down to whether the money is there. The evidence-based formula takes into account a whole lot of factors that would affect the school experience. For example, they count how many kids are English learners, how many are low income, how many have other psychological problems, if you will, how many have special needs. There's a whole bunch of factors, and it figures out how much can a local school district get locally from property taxes, from other funding sources, compared to how much this formula determines would be needed to properly educate a child. And the state has fallen behind in terms of being able to fully fund, if you will, the formula for all schools. And it's not that we're not putting the money in, we are, but, and Peter, I think you had a conversation with the state school superintendent where he pointed out there are some things that are happening. For one thing, costs go up with inflation. You can't pay a teacher the same thing today that you paid him 10 years ago.
And that's right. The adequacy target, I think that's what you're getting at. It's a moving target. It keeps changing because costs keep going up. Labor costs go up, the cost of supplies, the cost of utilities, all kinds of things, the costs go up. And demographic patterns shift. The number of English language learners has been growing as more and more immigrants have been coming to Illinois. So costs are going up, and certain kinds of revenue, there's an odd sort of revenue source out there that schools receive, has been declining. Essentially, the $300 or $350 million a year in additional funding that's called for in EBF appears to just not be enough to cover the increased costs. And so the pressure is on, and many groups would say, for the state of Illinois to increase the amount of money it adds to the formula each year.
The State Board of Education has come out and said, here's how the money is being allocated this year. And if you're in Tier 1, which is the furthest away from adequacy, your students will get $3,000 roughly per student. If you're in Tier 2, which is still not adequately funded, but not as far away as at Tier 1, you'll get roughly $500 a kid. If you're Tier 3, you get $24 a kid. If you're Tier 4, the ones that are best funded, get $1.36 per kid. And that shows how the money that the state puts into this funding is very much steered towards the neediest. But as you said, Peter and Sean, the gap keeps growing, and we don't have the funds to put in to make up the difference.
All right. Well, time now for our notes from the field. Peter, we'll go to you first.
Well, the other story this week that a lot of people are talking about is the fact that Meta, the owners of Facebook and Instagram and other social media platforms, settled a multi-state, settled a lawsuit filed by many, many states for somewhere in the neighborhood of $17 billion. Illinois' share of that is going to be about $750 million. And so watch for a feeding frenzy. Everybody in the world is going to want a slice of this $750 million pot of free money that just landed in their lap. The Illinois Federation of Teachers was the first to come out with a statement saying this should go to the schools that they argue are underfunded. But that is absolutely not going to be the last word. Governor Pritzker is already warning that this is one-time money and it should not be used to pay for any category of ongoing expenses. But that's going to be the great political fight for the next several weeks, I predict.
Absolutely. And Charlie?
Illinois got some good news from Moody's credit agency. They upgraded our bond ratings to A1 with a stable outlook. It's the highest rating from the agency since 2011, and it's the 11th time a credit rating agency has upgraded the state's credit rating since Pritzker was elected. And according to the analysis by Moody's, the state's financial metrics have improved with balanced budget. State spending outside the core areas of healthcare, pensions, and education has grown by less than 1% in each of the last 2 years. But the agency also said the state is still being held back by unfunded pension liabilities and constitutional limits, barring the state from changing pension benefits. As I said, the credit upgrade is good news for the state, which at one point had 24 consecutive downgrades, including 8 during the 2-year budget impasse between 2015 and 2017 between Governor Rauner and the legislature. But we still have the lowest credit rating in the nation.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Peter Hancock with Capital News Illinois. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.
Support for State Week comes from the members of the Illinois Education Association, serving 135,000 members of educators and support professionals around Illinois. IEA's mission is to promote excellence and equity in public education. When schools and communities unite, we all win. Resources and membership information at ieanea.org.